Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Bill Press Pod. I'm Jason Dick, deputy editor at CQ Roll Call, and I'm guest hosting this week while Bill is off. As usual on Friday, we have our roundtable of journalists to discuss the week's political news. The House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the Capitol is taking shape, sort of. Speaker Nancy Pelosi earlier this month named her eight picks, including Republican Liz Cheney. This week, House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy named his five picks, but then Pelosi vetoed two of them. Come Tuesday, when the panel meets for its first hearing, we still don't know who all will show up. Meanwhile, infrastructure summer continues, kind of, with one step back in the Senate and another step forward. Protests against voting restrictions ramped up, including on the Capitol grounds. And the COVID-19 pandemic reminded us all it's not quite done making people sick, including in the Congress and at the White House. Joining me today to talk about these topics and more are Amanda Becker, Washington correspondent for the 19th News. Hello, Amanda.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Jason.
And Abby Livingston, D.C. bureau chief for the Texas Tribune, appearing with us on the pod for the first time. Abby, welcome. And while we've got you here at the beginning, tell us a little bit about your gig at the Texas Tribune.
Yes, thanks so much for having me. The Texas Tribune, which is a newish news organization in the context of, we're about a little over 10 years old, and we're the largest statewide news organization in the state of Texas. So the state continues to accelerate in making news and keeps us busy.
It certainly does, and we're going to talk about some of your home state folks from Texas who have migrated to D.C. for a little interregnum in their lives over voting rights. So we'll get to that in a little bit. But again, welcome. It's great to have you on the show. And let's start off talking about voting rights. Amanda, you spent part of your recent time in reporting down in Georgia for a voting rights hearing that the Senate Rules and Administration Committee convened. Tell us about your reporting trip and the significance of why Amy Klobuchar and her merry band went to Georgia in the first place.
Yes. So they were in Georgia because Georgia was one of the first states this year to pass one of the restrictive voting laws we've seen Republican state legislatures pass this year. And so they took kind of the field hearing process to Georgia. It was in the Atlanta area. Georgia obviously voted for Joe Biden. It's the first Democrat they've backed since 1992. They have two Democratic senators for the first time in a long time. And that kind of inspired this backlash at the Republican legislature. And they passed a restrictive law. And so the senators went down to hear about kind of how that was impacting people on the ground there. It was their first field hearing. I don't think it will be the last.
I would guess not. Scott, you have been up on the Hill for quite a long time and seen the way these issues sort of play out, where people, they get very interested in addressing a topic, and then, you know, somebody says no and it sort of goes away. I feel like with all the protests that have gone on the Democratic side and so forth, people who are thinking that a lot of these voting restrictions are really like sort of an assault on our ideas of democracy. It seems like we're not seeing a lot on the Hill, right?
Well, what we're seeing on the Hill are protests over in some of the Senate buildings, including by top members of the Congressional Black Caucus. You saw Joyce Beatty, the leader of the Black Caucus, last week get arrested while protesting and trying to urge the Senate to pass voting rights. Yesterday, Hank Johnson was among those arrested. So you're seeing protests, but the reason why they're protesting is because not only frustration at Senate Republicans, but also frustration at the Biden administration and the president himself, because just last week he gave a big speech saying, look, voting rights and the assault on voting rights is the most significant test of our democracy since the Civil War. And yet progressives and other activists and CBC members feel like he's not putting any political muscle behind an effort to get it passed over in the Senate. It already passed the House, where Nancy Pelosi and the House Democrats control. But they want the president to use the bully pulpit even more to get on the phones, to work every angle. And they feel that's not really happening because they feel like he's entirely focused at the moment on his infrastructure package, on the $3.5 trillion human infrastructure plan for later this year, and other stuff they believe is sort of falling by the wayside.
Yeah, and actually we've got a little sound clip of the president talking about voting rights that you mentioned.
I want to see the United States Congress, the United States Senate, pass S1 and S4, the John Lewis Act, get into my desk so I can sign it. But here's the deal. What I also want to do, I want to make sure we bring along not just all the Democrats. We bring along Republicans who I know better. They know better than this.
Abby, you are, again, a Texan yourself, and you're witnessing sort of this migration of Texas Democrats in the legislature to Washington to talk to try to, you know, cast some attention on what Texas is trying to do on voting restrictions. Is the president is he being realistic, you think, about the willingness of Republicans to play ball? It seems like you're the Texas Democrats who came here don't think that Republicans are really sort of meeting them even halfway.
Well, they were excited yesterday because they met, sources were correct, they were on track. I'm assuming it happened. They met with staffers to Senators Lisa Murkowski and Pat Toomey. And so I think they're looking at every option in any way, whether it's breaking the filibuster, carving out the filibuster, working with Republicans. I think that they're ready to play ball no matter which path seems viable. I just really have a hard time seeing a viable path at this point on any of these tracks. But these Texans have been assured by congressional leaders, top Democrats in the country, that there is still a way to make this happen. They're hopeful. But, as a longtime congressional observer, I just have a really hard time seeing how this works out for Democrats.
Yeah, it does seem like just one of those intractable things. I mean, Scott, you mentioned that Hank Johnson, was arrested, this week, Joyce Beatty last week. I'm guessing that we'll see some more of these protests on the Hill. But like Abby said, I mean, the regardless of who the visitors are, I mean, it doesn't seem like Mitch McConnell is even like it's even a second thought that he would lend any kind of ability to move to this with the filibuster rules the way they are.
Yeah, that's right. And Joe Biden is sort of giving McConnell and others cover as he's facing pressure to get rid of the filibuster or have a carve out for the voting rights issue, as Abby mentioned. Just at a town hall event, a CNN town hall event in Cincinnati this week, Joe Biden was pressed on whether he would change the filibuster, especially for voting rights. And he said he rejected that idea, as he's done for months on end, including during the campaign, saying it would throw the entire Congress into chaos. So look, Joe Biden is a deal maker. He's somebody known for having good relations across the aisle. He's an institutionalist who served in the Senate for, 35 plus years. And so he's not about to get rid of the filibuster. He's made that crystal clear. And so, as Abby said, it's really hard to see a path forward when voting rights is not the preeminent issue of this administration in terms of what they're trying to do this year before we get into 2022, which is the election year. And then, everything sort of gets bogged down at that point.
Amanda, you've made a point of making sure you get out among voters outside of Washington, with the Georgia trip that you covered and the voting rights field hearing, that you covered, just the latest. I mean, What's it like in these situations? Are people, is it just activists sort of showing up on this? Are there folks that seem like genuinely concerned outside of, you know, people who we would know to call? Is it a regular person sort of concern, or is this something that, you know, conversations that politicians are having with themselves?
I do think some of this is starting to break through. So the field hearing itself in Atlanta was not open to the general public. Atlanta is still pretty shut down from COVID. I was kind of surprised the level to which it's still shut down. Senator Klobuchar had gone to Raphael Warnock's church that morning, but they're still doing virtual services, for example. But we are seeing protests in places like West Virginia that, you know, might not necessarily be the first state you'd think of when it comes to like protesting voting rights. It's a very white state. And it's Black activists who have been kind of leading the charge on this. But, you know, Black voters are who elected Joe Biden. They elected Joe Biden. So I don't think that this is something that politicians are going to be able to ignore, including the White House. And I do think that it's an issue that's on people's radar because these state laws have gotten so much press.
I feel like we could kind of go on a little bit on this, but I think that we're going to see more happen. Eventually, those Texas Democrats will have to go home. Eventually, they'll run out of folks to arrest, perhaps in the Senate Hart building. But I do want to jump from here to talk about another sort of important topic, which is this select committee that the House formed to investigate the January 6th attacks. You know, this was the fallback position originally. That there was a proposal to start a bipartisan and nonpartisan, you know, kind of commission along the lines of the 9/11 commission. No current office holders would be able to serve on it. And they would be given a sort of a wide palette that died in the Senate, even though it got, you know, more than 50 votes to proceed. So the fallback position for Nancy Pelosi in the House was the Select Committee. Republican leaders were not interested in playing ball with it. And for the most part, they kept their ranks together. Scott, have you seen this sort of animosity? Once Nancy Pelosi said Jim Banks and Jim Jordan, two of Kevin McCarthy's picks for the committee, have you seen this kind of animosity? This didn't seem fake. Before you talk, we have a clip from McCarthy I want to play.
Why is Nancy Pelosi so afraid of the truth coming out? We cannot afford to have a speaker like this.
I mean, people like to feign that they're angry and so forth, Ben, and McCarthy is playing the hand he has dealt. But this seems kind of real, this sort of venom that they're spitting at each other.
Well, I think what's important to note is that, you know, the venom between the two parties has been there since January 6th, since the attack was underway, since the days after the attack. The fact that Republicans, nearly all Republicans, took to the floor and voted to overturn the election in the moments right after the Capitol was sacked. And so my takeaway is that this animosity, this anger between the two parties, you see it in the halls. There's just not as many smiles and slaps on the back as there used to be between the two parties. It hasn't gone away. And here we are 6 months later, the wounds haven't healed. And that's sort of my takeaway after observing lawmakers this week. There's not a lot of joy on Capitol Hill, and certainly not a lot of bipartisanship, unless you're talking about infrastructure. But And on a personal level, Pelosi and McCarthy have never really gotten along that well. They're of different generations. They're different type. Their politics are very different. And they've never really had the same rapport as Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner or even Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell, who have worked together for decades.
Abby, one thing I wondered about when Nancy Pelosi sort of, you know, vetoed Jim Jordan and Banks, did she miss an opportunity, perhaps? I mean, we knew that Jordan would probably go in, to do kind of what he did with impeachment. Did she miss an opportunity to have Jim Jordan face Mike Fanone, the D.C. Metro police officer who was among those defending the Capitol and has been very vocal on CNN and is a fairly charismatic and aggressive dude?
I, I mean, possibly. I think she is, I think Republicans who will so often say privately, she's one of the smartest strategic thinkers on Capitol Hill and has been for a long time. And, you know, politicians' memoirs are often very dull, but hers is interesting. And I believe the title of hers is Know Your Power. So she understood her power in this circumstance and leaned into it. One other thing is just, I think living in Washington, and I have not been out much since with COVID out into other parts of the country for several months, but Washington is really shaken by this January 6th in a way that I don't think the rest of the country understands. This is fundamental to so many people who work at the Capitol. There's PTSD everywhere you look. And this is such a personal drama playing out in a way there is no other drama I've seen in my career. And on top of that, just one other note, McCarthy, I'd never seen him like that in that news conference. But on Instagram, he posted a photo of Jim Banks and Jim Jordan and referred to them as Nancy Pelosi's worst nightmare. And I just kind of wonder, you know, I know that's political rhetoric, but looking back, I honestly, you know, I don't want to speak for Nancy Pelosi, but I would think her worst nightmare is being killed by a mob at the United States Capitol. And it's just, I think the rhetoric there is just fascinating.
Yeah, I was wondering about that myself because this, I mean, Nancy Pelosi really is one of the more skilled politicians and one of the more powerful people who has practiced politics in the United States Congress. And, you know, Amanda, what do you think that this, you know, just sort of feeds a narrative that Democrats are actually kind of care, you know, very comfortable with, which is that Nancy Pelosi is there to stand up to people who she, you know, is very comfortable pushing back on with some of the rhetoric that they've been employing?
You know, I've been going back and forth about her decision to remove these picks from the committee and how that would play with voters and whether, you know, voters like Abby said, who aren't in the Washington area, have really been following this as closely as we have and some of the things that various lawmakers have said leading up to this. I mean, you already had the one Republican who's already on the committee, Representative Cheney, as we found out within the past week or so. Apparently, Jim Jordan came up to her on the floor the day of the insurrection and she swatted his hand away and said, "You did this," and rejected his offer of help. So I'm not sure how you can have these people on a committee together actually working towards a common goal, because it's pretty clear that the Republican appointees to the committee would be on the large part working towards a very different goal. I go back and forth between how do you do that? And also, you know, is there going to be a political cost on Democrats' part to now this is going to look like the partisan process that Republicans have been saying it will be?
And speaking of Liz Cheney, again, this is the daughter of, you know, former Vice President Dick Cheney, the former number three Republican in leadership who was booted from her post for continuing to call out Donald Trump's, lies about election fraud and so forth. We have speaking of being forceful and being not afraid to say what she thinks, we have a short clip from Cheney herself.
The rhetoric that we have heard from the minority leader is disingenuous. And at every opportunity, the minority leader has attempted to prevent the American people from understanding what happened, to block this investigation. Today, the speaker objected to two Republican members, one of whom may well be a material witness to events that led to January 6th.
Scott, she's referring to Jim Jordan, who may have been on the line with the president and may be called before the committee. And then also just, you know, like the side note, the context that we know, we who cover leadership stuff like this, Jim Banks was among the people, kind of spearheading her ouster as the number three Republican.
Right. And don't forget, Kevin McCarthy also spoke to President Trump as the attack was underway. In fact, I pressed him on that during a press conference just this week, asking if he would stand by his words that he would testify before any investigating committee on that phone call, and he sort of dodged my question. But to the earlier point about whether Democrats maybe have overreached here, I think we're starting to see Democrats respond to that line of criticism, because Nancy Pelosi, as we understand it, is now entertaining the idea of bringing on more Republicans on this committee in addition to Liz Cheney. One name that keeps popping up is Adam Kinzinger, who is a centrist Republican from Illinois, an outspoken Trump critic who has been very vocal about Trump's involvement on January 6th. A member of the military, he has a military background, and so we also saw former Congressman Denver Riggleman, a Republican, former intelligence officer who was on the Hill yesterday meeting with the January 6th investigative team. He's possibly could serve as a staffer, a Republican staffer on the committee. So it appears that Democrats are cognizant of this appearance, that it could appear more like a partisan investigation, as McCarthy has charged, and they're looking for ways to make this appear at least more bipartisan.
Yeah, I just think, you know, this is going to help define the midterms as we you know, sort of ramp up. We still don't know who's running in what districts because the census and realignment is still kind of underway. But I think that this is going to hang over it all. Hey, before we get to our next topic, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
And today's podcast brought to you by the Laborers International Union of North America, or LIUNA, L-I-U-N-A. Over 500,000 strong under the leadership of President Terry O'Sullivan, members of the Laborers Union building America and ready to rebuild America's infrastructure and taking care of our energy supply by building everything from old-fashioned pipelines to new wind turbines and solar panels. Check out their website, liuna.org, and we thank the members of the Laborers Union for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's B-Y-T-E.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And we are back. I'm Jason Dick, deputy editor at CQ Roll Call, your guest host this week while Bill is off. Joining me this Friday are Amanda Becker, Washington correspondent for the 19th News, Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill, and Abby Livingston, D.C. bureau chief for the Texas Tribune. It is, I joke that it was infrastructure summer. Infrastructure week became kind of a punchline during the Trump administration because we were always assured that they were going to make a lot of progress on it. It seems like they have, Congress and the administration do have a desire to address the country's infrastructure woes, as well as shoehorn some other policy priorities on it. The president spoke in Cincinnati, Amanda Becker's hometown, earlier this week. Abby, I'm curious. I mean, do you think that infrastructure, I mean, while it certainly is a popular thing with members, is this something that moves voters?
Well, I think it depends on how it's presented politically and how significant it is. You know, the term stimulus became a dirty word when we were in the financial crisis in 2009, and the Obama effort, which was just a petty less than $1 trillion to stimulate the economy and shovel ready projects. You know, the branding on it was, I can't even, the Recovery Act or something like that, and people did not connect it with the political language. And so I think it depends on how it's presented. I mean, we look back at FDR and, you know, that formed a generation of political alliances. But I think it's to be seen. But boy, Democrats seem to have a lot invested in this, and they seem to think that this is the thing that can help them through what appears to be a tough midterm ahead.
That's for sure. Amanda, I mentioned that the president was in Cincinnati. One of the lead senators who is trying to negotiate the sort of, for lack of a better term, physical infrastructure, bridges, roads, and so forth, is Rob Portman. He's a senator. He's retiring. He's a Republican, and he's from the Cincinnati area. You know, one, where you must have just been thrilled to see your city represented.
Oh, I'm always thrilled when Cincinnati is in the news, especially if it's not for an embarrassing reason.
Right. But, you know, and, you know, again, Cincinnati is sort of like an old shoe that that people go to when old comfortable shoe when they want to show crumbling infrastructure, because the Brent Spence Bridge is there. It traverses Kentucky and Ohio and carries I-71 and I-75. Having driven that bridge, it is terrifying. But again, the same question. Is this the kind of thing that people think of, like, that when they're in the voting booth? I mean, is this what drives them to vote, or is it more along the lines of voting rights and so forth?
I think people are paying attention to infrastructure in the, you know, specifically kind of what their state will get for various projects. But I think what voters are paying more attention to potentially is the second phase, the human infrastructure phase, because that has a lot of components that, if passed, will have a pretty noticeable and pretty immediate impact on some people's lives. Like these child tax credit payments that went out earlier this month. You know, more than 80% of families were eligible to receive that, and that was just money that showed up in their account from the stimulus. And one thing that the human infrastructure package would do is make that permanent. Right now, it's temporary. So I do think that they're paying attention to these negotiations, but I think it's potentially the second round that could have some more kind of in real life at the voting booth impact.
And Scott, we've seen, you know, this sort of, you know, dance. We had a failed vote in the Senate to advance the bipartisan infrastructure plan that Portman and nine other senators have been sort of negotiating. Democrats seem ready. The Democratic leaders, at least, seem ready to go their own way. What are you going to be watching for in the coming week or so with this push pull?
Well, exactly, because, you know, Chuck Schumer is under a lot of pressure with time running out before senators and House members head on vacation for the August recess. I mean, we only have about a week left to get something done on infrastructure before Democrats decide to ditch these bipartisan talks and go it alone. But I think what's motivating Biden and the White House and some of these Democratic senators is, number one, Biden ran on bipartisanship, on sort of restoring bipartisanship and civility to Washington. And so he has a lot riding on this bipartisan deal. And secondly, the people involved in these talks, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema, all of these centrist Democrats, this core group, are essential to whatever the Democrats will move in this second phase, $3.5 trillion human infrastructure plan, because Democrats have zero wiggle room. They have 50 votes. They need everyone on board if they're going to pass this $3.5 trillion that will be transformational for not only the country, but for Biden's legacy. And so they're thinking about all of these things. This is part of the calculation, and I think part of why Democrats and certainly Joe Biden are so invested in getting something done on a bipartisan basis on infrastructure.
All right. We're going to talk about everyone's least favorite topic, which is the COVID-19 pandemic. Certainly, we had sort of a boost of optimism earlier in the summer, late spring, when we all sort of got fully vaccinated. Not all of us, but many of the people that we know, certainly the region that we're in the capital, masks came off, bars open, restaurants, we could go to the movies again. And now we are seeing a little bit of a fallback. And I will say this about COVID. It is difficult to get Joe Biden and Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, on the same page about it. But we've got a clip from Governor DeSantis about the COVID vaccine.
If you are fully vaccinated, the chance of you getting seriously ill or dying from COVID is effectively zero. And so these vaccines are saving lives. They are reducing mortality.
Abby, we saw, earlier in the pandemic that Ron DeSantis was not as concerned, it seemed, about restrictions, about, making sure that Florida was following as many precautions as they could. And now we are at a turning point. It's not just DeSantis. It's people like Steve Scalise, who got his first Pfizer shot last weekend. Even Sean Hannity has gone on to exhort his viewers to get a vaccine. What's changed?
Well, I don't know what has sparked this, because we have seen a dramatic change in tone in the last few days. But, I can just, from personal political observations, the Texas delegation of state reps who are up here, they had an outbreak and they're all quarantining, and we could see the change just instantly in that lobby. They were wearing masks, and I talked to some Capitol Hill sources and I was like, are y'all nervous about meeting with the Texans? And there's a widespread sense that like any population group is probably got COVID in it among vaccinated people, and they're mostly asymptomatic. So I think that for a lot of folks, we thought we were ready to move on and that we turned a page. And, I have a relative who had some health issues, and the feedback from it was unrelated to COVID, but the emergency rooms are full and all over again, and healthcare workers are exhausted. And so, I just wonder how much patience the rest of the country has who has been vaccinated with the rest of the country who won't get on the same page.
Yeah, Amanda, I feel like maybe one of the issues that came up is that with the Delta variant, a lot of the what we're seeing is that the vaccinated populations in the United States are not getting sick, but the areas that are not vaccinated are, and this is something Scalise himself talked about, and I wonder, are they thinking like, wow, we can't just have like our people getting sick?
Yeah, I don't know what was behind the Republican sea change this week, kind of on vaccine messaging. Of course, you did have the Dow dropping 900 points one day, so maybe that got their attention on that day. I think that maybe people are just finally realizing this Delta variant is very bad, and some of the things that they've said that have made people vaccine hesitant perhaps in the past have kind of gotten us to where we are. And I think it's looking like there's a very real possibility that places are going to have to shut back down if they want to control virus control, which I think is the absolute worst outcome for pretty much any city or locality. I mean, LA is back to indoor mask wearing. I have personally started wearing a mask again because I think that the breakthrough rate is turning out to be a lot higher than we thought. And while you are protected if you're vaccinated, from the Delta variant that's very serious, there might be future variants that develop in the unvaccinated population that the vaccine won't be as effective on. And we're also dealing with a situation where every child under 12 is still not vaccinated. So if you have a breakthrough infection and you're going back home to your kids, that then becomes a huge issue.
And Scott, Abby mentioned this with some of the Texas Democrats, meeting on the Hill last week, on the print newspaper that I help put together Roll Call, one of our front pages was a bunch of unmasked people meeting with Chuck Schumer from Texas. And that is gone. But it's not just people meeting with them. I mean, there's a kind of a sea change up at the Capitol where it was like bacchanal, right? Like about a month ago or so. And now people are slowly masking back up in the Capitol, it seems.
I mean, on Monday, when I first entered the Capitol, almost nobody was wearing masks. Tuesday morning, I walked into the Capitol and I saw about 20 staffers all wearing masks. And I was asking myself, what's going on here? And what had happened, and I didn't realize it, but Pelosi and her entire entourage had walked into a meeting, a closed door meeting with Democrats, all wearing masks for the first time in weeks. And what had happened, we later found out, was that a White House staffer who was meeting with the Texas delegation and a Pelosi senior communications aide who also was in contact with the delegation had tested positive. And those positive tests were coming back, and it created a little bit of a panic in the Capitol. All of a sudden, there was a long line again in the COVID testing site inside the Capitol. And, it just showed that it felt like a huge step backwards, you know, and reflective of the huge step back we're taking in the country overall as we start to see more mask mandates and more restrictions putting in place in some of these local jurisdictions. So, the fear is real, especially related to the cases that are breaking out among the vaccinated. Look, I have three children at home, all under 12, and so they're not vaccinated. So it is a real fear among people who work in the Capitol about bringing COVID home to their families, and people who are outside the Capitol bringing it home to their families.
Yes, very, very scary stuff. And I didn't mean to end on a downer. So we'll go from there to the news of our favorite stories of the week. This is the part of the podcast where we talk about a story that's just a little off the news that we cover for a living and about politics and so forth. It can be about politics, but we, maybe outside of the purview of some of the stuff we've talked about. So, Abby, you are the guest of honor. Being your first appearance, we're going to let you go first.
Well, I'm honored. I would say my favorite story of the week. It's something of a doom and gloom story in its own right, but and it's an old story. But Julie K. Brown, the Miami Herald reporter who broke the Jeffrey Epstein story a couple years ago and set into sequence the events that ended in his arrest, she's on book tour, and I've just loved listening to her interviews about her process and her determination. It's just like a good reminder as a reporter of what excellence is and to kind of up my game a bit. And so I've just truly enjoyed listening to her because it's just such phenomenal reporting.
Excellent. Amanda, what's your favorite story of the week?
Well, it feels weird to choose this under the word favorite. So I will preface this by saying this is not my favorite story, but it's it's one that I can't stop thinking about. And it was in the New Yorker. I think the date it was technically published is the 19th, although it's from the July 26th issue.
Shameless plug for your publication, yes.
it was by Rachel Aviv, and the title is The German Experiment That Placed Foster Children with Pedophiles. And I just, my jaw was on the floor for most of this story. And one of the people she interviews in the story who was placed with a pedophile, I mean, this was going on until 2002 or 2003. And it was kind of this social experiment being carried out in Germany where they, you know, like the title says, placed foster children with pedophiles. So I have not been able to stop thinking about that story.
As you said, a jaw dropper. It is just unbelievable to think that anybody at any point thought that this was a good idea. It's just
especially
incredible.
So recently, and also just many trigger warnings for anyone who goes to look that up and read it.
Scott, how about you?
Well, you know, we have a couple swimmers in our family, two daughters, one of whom will be in a big swim meet this weekend. And so we will be rooting on, of course, we didn't get to the Olympics, but we will be rooting on some of the local D.C. area Olympians who are in Tokyo as the games kick off. And I know there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of serious stories concerning the Olympics, you know, possible COVID outbreaks and protests. But hopefully this will be a distraction from some of the heavier news. And we have, you know, just in our own local area, you know, Katie Ledecky and Phoebe Bacon, the swimmer, as well as Kevin Durant from PG County, who will be on the NBA Olympic basketball team. So we're looking forward to a lot of good games.
Oh, and a Texas Longhorn, Kevin Durant.
There you go. I was going to put in my my local hook on there, too, which is that after a heartbreaking loss in the NBA Finals, Devin Booker of the Phoenix Suns is also an NBA Olympian. So I'm also looking forward to some good stories there, too. My favorite story is a little weird. I will admit, I started thinking about this a little bit with all the billionaires we've been shooting into space. You know, first Richard Branson last week, and this week Jeff Bezos. You know, it's you know, criticism aside of like the propriety of like going into space, you know, at a time when the planet sort of needs those billions elsewhere. I mean, this is, I think, a part of like the human experience. But then again, like returning to the New Yorker, I came back to this story about a movie called Settlers that Anthony Lane wrote about and has been released this week. It's a movie by Wyatt Rockefeller, and it's a, consider it sort of a reality check about like what would happen if we were able to get off the planet if it continues to go to hell and settle somewhere else, and which is that it kind of poses the question, what if Mars in this case just sucks? what if it's one of these places that it's not such a picnic from being on Earth as much a challenge as a dystopic future may face. So it's I mean, I'm a sci-fi guy and a movie guy, as most of you all know if you've listened to me for like 5 minutes. But I thought, you know, this is a fun sort of wrap up of the billionaires in space. I mean, I'm sure that we'll eventually return to space, you know, for you know, somebody besides those worth billions of dollars. But it was a sort of a reality check that we really don't know what's waiting for us. So that's going to do it for this edition of the Bill Press Pod. Thank you for listening, and thank you to our panelists for sacrificing some very valuable coffee time this morning. Amanda Becker, Washington correspondent for 19th News. Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you.
Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill. Much obliged, Scott.
Thanks a lot.
And again, welcome to Abby Livingston. First of, we hope, many appearances on the Bill Press Pod. Thank you very much, Abby, DC Bureau Chief for the Texas Tribune.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.